Hello, everyone, and welcome to One Control Report Podcast, episode 92. Benjamin Yoder here today with the guest.
Hello.
Hello, Vink from Famicom Dojo.
Yes, from Famicom. Well, yes.
Yeah, and although Retro Direct.
Yes, that's true. Although recently, kind of Famicom Dojo is on a bit of a hiatus right now, but hopefully getting some new content out there sometime soon. Yes, I'm Vink, coming to you from beautiful, majestic, and cold Japan. So
I complain about the cold here all the time in Las Vegas, but I'm sure it's not nearly as cold as out there.
Well, you know what? I'm originally from Wisconsin, so compared to that, Japan's pretty warm, too.
Okay, yeah.
It rarely snows here, but they haven't gotten that whole central heating thing yet.
They
invented like the kotatsu and the heated toilet seat, but not like and they say, oh, you don't have kotatsus. Kotatsu is like a heated table with a blanket over it, just in case the listeners aren't aware. But and like a heated toilet seat is, well, exactly that. and they say, oh, do you have those in Wisconsin because it's so cold? And I said, no, we don't have those. And they're like, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, well, our bathroom's warm because we have heat. So
in Las Vegas, it's not so bad out here, but I think it's like in Oregon. They also have, I forget if it's heat or cold there, they typically don't have like AC units or things like that. One or the other. I've always lived in places my whole life with like AC and a heater, so I feel weird going to somewhere where they're like, nope, we just don't have that here. I'm like, So when I originally found out about you guys through Famicom Dojo, this is like 2006, whenever Phil Bond put his Totaka song video out.
My goodness.
Probably that's, ended up on Go Nintendo, and that's probably how I found out.
Yeah, that predates Famicom Dojo, that video, but it was kind of what inspired us to do it. And I think, oh my goodness, I think that was back in like maybe 2004, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
You might have found it after it'd been around for a while, but
upload date is 2006 on YouTube. But I don't know if it existed somewhere else before that or you guys were on Powit TV. I don't know if they hosted their own videos over there.
No. It was all through YouTube. Yeah, we're one of the early people on YouTube, and that's why a lot of our early videos are so short, because YouTube used to have a 10-minute limit.
Oh yeah,
or 15 or something like that. It was short, so we had to make our videos short to accommodate for that. So a lot of people wonder why, you know, the early videos were so short. It's because of that. We couldn't do anything longer until we became like, I don't know, a partner or something. I don't know how it was, but yeah, we predate. We were doing this when PewDiePie was in diapers. Actually, I think he's only a couple years younger than me now that I think about
it. Oh, really?
I like to imagine that he was in diapers when we started. So,
so I think by that time, were you already living in Japan?
Yes. Okay. Famicom Dojo started after I moved to Japan.
Gotcha. And did you move to Japan mainly because of the whole retro, or not, I guess maybe not retro games at that time. I guess, would they be considered retro games? Probably. I don't know. It's been a while.
I mean, the Famicom was definitely retro when I came here. I'm not that old. But I have been here for almost 15 years now. So, let's see. I came before the Nintendo DS was released.
All right, so
pre-2004. I was here for the launch of that. I was here for the launch of the Wii. So if that gives any date, GameCube was current Nintendo tech when I got here, and you know, the PlayStation 2 was the big one, but Dreamcast games were still being made when I moved here. That'll put it in perspective. Yeah. Oh, Neo Geo games were still being made when I moved here.
Neo Geo lasted a long time. I forgot. It did. I always forget about that. Yeah,
it did.
So at the time when you moved out there, I mean, I was a kid watching this, like the people in Japan shopping and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what press sites were up at the time, but if you're familiar with like Chris Kohler and Jeremy Parrish and people like that.
Yeah. This was like the joystick era, and I mean, I wrote for a time for Four Color Rebellion, which was, it's still around, but it was kind of a bigger Nintendo site back then.
Yeah, and at the time, I think it was the kind of the big narrative around that was that, you know, games are super cheap in Japan. They're everywhere. Yep. And yep. And you could basically bring back, you know, luggage full of, you know, dirt cheap Famicom games at the time. I'm not sure what platforms, you know, to what extent, how high up the platforms went in terms of, like, if you could get cheap PlayStation games at that time, or if that was something that came down the line.
That was definitely a time when Saturn was really cheap, but, like, since PlayStation had the backwards compatibility still going on with, like, PlayStation 2, mm-hmm. those games didn't drop. I mean, they're dirt cheap now, PlayStation. It's a great time to get into PlayStation right now, and PlayStation 2. Those are really good platforms to invest in right now. They're going to get more expensive because the nostalgia is going to kick in pretty soon. Not quite yet, as Sony just learned with the Classic. Yeah. But
some other problems with the Classic outside of
Oh, my God. That's another podcast in and of itself. But that's a good platform. But when I came here, I still remember there was a game store near me that had, like, Sega Saturn games. They were 3 for 500 yen. So that's, mm-hmm. like... you know, a little, you know, what does that even work out to, you know, under $2 each. The exchange rate's always in flux, but I think at that time that's what it worked out to be. And, you know, Famicom stuff was dirt cheap and everywhere. There was, like, any shop that sold new games usually sold used games as well, which is not true anymore. When I moved to my little city, which is, again, I'm not in Tokyo or anything, I'm in a little city in Kyushu, and there were 11 places I could buy retro games at the time. There were just in a town, you know, not very big at all. And now there's only 4 choices.
Oh, wow. That's a lot smaller. Yeah.
It is significantly, yeah.
That being said, everywhere I've lived has always had barely any places, so...
I suppose. But for Japan, like, that was one of the things. So, yeah, you used to go on... I think it was Kotaku especially, because you had Brian Ashcraft always talking about... you know, just walking around Japan and, you know, living the life. Nice guy, actually. I met him at Tokyo Game Show. You know, you'd read his stuff or whatever. And I think that inspired a lot of people to come to Japan and things like that. I didn't come for the retro. I tell myself I didn't come for the games. Like, I tell myself I came for, like, the experience of living in Japan and, learning about a new culture and things like that. But I mean, games definitely shaped why I became interested in this country in the first place.
Yeah. I think it's a big part of it, but at the end of the day, you don't make moving decisions based off, I'm going to get a bunch of cheap Famicom games or something like that.
Oh man, I hope I've
made some bad decisions in my life too.
But... oh man, This podcast is going to cause me to do a little self-reflection afterwards. So,
it's not like it worked out either way.
Let's say for the record that I didn't come to Japan for that, but that it's a nice perk. It's a nice perk.
Gotcha.
Of living here. So, so I guess that's what we're talking about today, right?
Yeah, I was kind of curious. So, when you started noticing that shift. In prices, if it was like a something that seemed kind of sudden, or if it seemed like a gradual change, like you just saw prices slowly going up and things like that, or
I think it started out that the prices would be creeping a little bit, and then it kind of goes in jolts. Let's look at some like online shops. Like, you used to be able to go to, well, not an online shop, but like you used to be able to go to the chain stores like Book Off.
Yeah.
And their game prices used to start at about 50 yen. That, which is, yeah, like 50 cents. And that would get you a lot of the common games. You know, you're looking at your Famicom Baseball, you're looking at your Game Boy Yu-Gi-Oh games, you know, the things that are like really, really common. And but it covered a wide variety of things, and then slowly some of the games that used to be 50 yen started to creep up to the 100 yen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were still some. And now nothing is that cheap anymore. Like, now games start at 100 yen, and basically there's none that are that anymore, unless it's like a really faded copy of some game where the label's missing. You know, it's other than that, basically a used game now kind of starts around $2.50, which is still cheap, but like even then, not a lot of games are at that point. It's just I find that a lot of the things for Famicom, Super Famicom, are about 3 or 4 times more expensive than when I came here 15 years ago, and PC Engine has become about 10 times as expensive. Yeah. You used to be able to get PC Engine games for almost nothing. I mean, gosh, do you know the game Gunhead? It came out in America as Blazing Lasers. It's considered a classic shooter.
Yeah, it's of the PC Engine.
The PC Engine.
Very unfamiliar with the PC Engine, unfortunately.
Okay. Okay. Well, despite any having PC Engine effects. Yeah. Any PC Engine fans listening will be like, oh, okay. Because it's considered one of those like must-have games. Mm-hmm. And I picked up my brand new copy of that for $10.
Yeah.
Now you'd be lucky to get a loose copy for $40, you know. Neo Geo game. Oh, Neo Geo. Oh my goodness. There was a time when you could get a copy of Samurai Showdown 2 for $5. Yeah. That doesn't even seem possible anymore, because now basically prices for Neo Geo stuff starts at about $25.
Gotcha.
Like for even the most common stuff. I bought my Neo Geo, my boxed Neo Geo, for $200.
Yeah.
Back in the day, and You know, there's where the regret comes in, because before I got married, I made a decision in my life that I was going to pretty much get rid of all my gaming stuff.
Oh, okay.
This is about 10 years ago. And as I said, I got this stuff really, really cheap, because I got it all when I first came to Japan. I had a fairly nice collection, but I'm like, okay, it's time to grow up. It's time to be an adult now.
I know where this story's going.
It's time to move on. And I kept the ones that I did a whole, Mario Kondo thing, you know, I looked at my games and I decided which ones sparked joy, yeah. You know. My favorites, and I kept basically a small shelf of games that really, you know, meant something to me, and I got rid of pretty much everything else, and for nothing. I just, you know, traded it in basically, and I'm like, okay, it's time to be an adult now. I'm getting married. It's time to put away childish things. You know, that lasted about a year.
And then it's time to recollect, and everything's expensive again.
And then I'm like, oh my goodness. And the thing is, rebuying the stuff cost me so much more. And I haven't rebought everything yet. Like, I used to have a boxed Famicom robot that I'd bought for like $25. Okay. Now, you know, you'd be lucky if you get one boxed complete for, you know, $150.
It's really pricey for a rob out here as well. Like,
yeah,
it's getting kind of crazy.
So
I would think that probably about like maybe it's been 5+ years ago at this point, I felt like I started seeing a lot of like blog posts pop online and say, hey, don't go to Akihabara anymore for buying games. It's getting kind of expensive. And I think there's a while people are like, go to Denden Town, and it sounds like Denden Town's also kind of not the greatest place anymore for that anymore. So I was wondering, you know, from, and I don't know how many people you know in terms of like inside the Japanese community who's also collectors, things like that. But I was wondering, is the topic of the rising game prices generally centered around the idea that Westerners are exporting that stuff out? And I was kind of wondering, what do you think the general like feeling is from that community, since, you know, that stuff was all made internally within Japan, and now people are, you know, exporting it out. And I guess, maybe to explain it a bit more, the theory is that basically a lot of these prices are going up because people are exporting games from Japan, and that stuff never goes back to Japan. So there's a lot less inventory around for different stores and things like that.
Well, I mean, that is a great question. It's de and like one can have a lot of theories, and personally, I think that's a huge part of it. But like from my Japanese friends, or maybe they don't tell me because I am a foreigner. You know what
Yeah,
I
I can
mean?
understand that, yeah.
But like there's a definite thought that the way that classic games are going has changed. Not even just classic games, but Japanese houses are small. And you know, people don't normally have, you know, a giant game room. You know, there it that's lab that's, you know, relegated to the people who are more of the like otaku gamer, you know. And there's definitely the whole idea of having value, you know, buying your new RPG, beating it, and selling it back to the store when you can still get half of the price back or even more. I mean, it's not like GameStop here. Like games actually do retain value as long as it's still something that's new. Like you know, recently if you would have bought like Kingdom Hearts 3 and you know just marathon that thing and sold it back, you wouldn't actually be losing that much money. But now you know it's already too late now because there's already used copies appearing. Basically, a store pays what they think they can sell it for, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So, now that we've found that Kingdom Hearts isn't the blockbuster hit that one had hoped, the price for the buyback has really tanked. But I mean that happens with anything,
Yeah.
but there's this idea that games are kind of an impermanent thing here.
Gotcha.
What I mean by that is people don't usually hold on to a collection because the game prices were so low that if you feel like playing a game again, it was both available and cheap. And that's gone away. Like, because now, okay, a lot of game shops, the stuff that they have on the shelves is garbage. You know, it's the stuff that they feel they can't sell on Yahoo auctions.
Yeah, Derby Stallion games or whatever, things like
Yeah,
that, I see.
exactly. But like you used to see things like Castlevania, you know, like the Dracula X Rondo of Blood. You used to see that on shelves for like $30. Yeah, $30. But now people are like, you know what? Americans will pay us $200 for this. And so a lot of that stuff is going away. PC Engine, I think, was hit the hardest of all. Because that used to be a very common system to find here, but like, you know, that thing, like all of that stuff is leaving Japan and going to other countries, and that's the biggest problem is once it leaves Japan, it never ever comes back.
Yeah. No one's
Like
going to
it'll,
import a
yeah.
Japanese game back from the
Exactly.
US into Japan,
Exactly.
so.
It's gone, and a lot of these things, you know, were never produced in high numbers, but you know, they've been passed around from gamer to gamer for a long time. People reselling them, buying them back, reselling them again. They weren't ever meant to have a stopping point. And
Yeah.
I realize as I say this that I am a huge part of this problem. I do an import store called what is it called?
Japan
Japan
Retro
Retro.
Direct, yeah.
Japan Retro Direct. Please visit Japan Retro Direct and help contribute to this problem.
But I imagine
But
you,
yeah.
at the same time, you also like, yes, I would probably agree with you that your store is contributing to that issue,
I
but
mean, yeah. Although
the service you're offering has
I'm
another
small
benefit to
potatoes,
it.
yeah.
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 Like
But
I'd
yeah.
imagine sharing this stuff with a Western market is something is part of the reason why you do this. Like I'd imagine you're not into
Well,
this for a bunch of money, you
oh my goodness. If I was, I'm doing it wrong. I mean, to tell you the honest truth, I mean, I have made no money off of Japan Retro
Yeah,
Direct,
I figured as
because
much.
I mean, I do tens of orders a year. You know what I mean? It's like, but the people I do interact with, well, like you, that's how we kind of started talking, really. Because I like to help people find the things they're looking for, and I don't like the whole scalper prices because games are becoming more expensive in Japan, but they're not as expensive as eBay leads one to believe.
Yeah, which I
And
found
the
that a lot with like when I imported Aconcagua originally from you, I think the eBay prices were like $60 to $80 just because there's like three copies listed on there, but when you found it, it was, I think, $14.
The games don't have to be as expensive as they are, and that's the problem. The reason all these games are leaving Japan, you know, is because Japanese people feel they can make more money selling them to foreigners, because people won't pay that much in Japan. People won't pay $200 for Castlevania Rondo of Blood here. They're just not buying it, you know. But so the stores are like, well, I could sell it in my store for $50, or I could put it online,
sell for $200
and get $200. And it's the fact that people are scalping their games for so much, the fact that people are selling their games for such high prices, is what is destroying the market. You know, because and here's how I justify in my mind what I'm doing. Almost all the things that I sell in my store are things I buy locally, you know, and I mostly buy from mom and pop organizations. I will occasionally support the chains like Book Off and things like that, but a lot of the stuff I'm getting from, you know, kind of local shops, and, you know, I pay the price that they're offering, and, you know, I'm just, you know, trying to get those games spread around. And of course, one of the big reasons I don't make a lot of money is because I'm also a collector myself. And I hate to say it. I mean, I think I put a lot of very good stuff on the shop, but the best stuff I keep for myself.
Yeah.
And if you see a really good game on there and you go, wow, how can you possibly be getting rid of this? It's because I have to. I mean, it is because... mostly what I like, doing the shop has also like helped my knowledge of retro gaming and everything, because I test everything that I sell, you know, just to make sure it works and everything. But more often than not, I want to play it for a while, you know, figure out what kind of game it is. So I try to decide whether it's something that if you didn't speak any Japanese, you'd be able to play or not. I think that's very important, because if you go on an eBay listing, they say they test every game, but I've gotten a lot of stuff that hasn't worked. You know what I mean? And especially when they say this game has been tested, but you see that they put a stock photo up.
Yeah. And then you have no idea what the quality is or anything like that.
Yeah. And you know, there's no description. You don't know, you know, what's going to happen, things like that. I never put up whether the battery works or not when I list games, because you never know what's going to happen between the time I put it online and when it, you know.
Yeah, and I imagine you're not soldering new batteries into like cartridges or something that. I know some local stores do that here, but
man, I am so not technical. Here, let me explain. let me explain. I have a stack of like old twin Famicoms and Famicom disk systems. I've got like two dead twin Famicoms and like three dead disk systems. They're not dead. I'm sure they work fine. They need a new rubber band. That's all they need.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because those deteriorate.
But,
yeah.
But I don't know how to do that. So whenever one of mine goes bad, I just buy a new one. like it's so inefficient, because the rubber bands are like $1.50, you know.
Yeah.
I'm so worried that if I open it up, I'm just going to ruin the whole thing. So what I've been doing is I just offer them, you know, online to someone, you know, for cheap, for real cheap. And, you know, I pay a little extra and I get myself one that someone has replaced the band for. And then that works for a couple years until another one breaks. And then I sell, you know, the cycle repeats itself.
Are those bands in relatively good supply, or is it something that's drying up or anything like that? Just as a quick side note.
There was a big problem a few years ago because Nintendo officially did maintenance and sold parts on the disk system up until like, gosh, 2010, I think.
Yeah,
like,
I think it was 30 years, right?
Like for a long time. But then the official parts stopped, and for a long time bands were going up in price. I remember seeing just the rubber band for like $20. For just this. But what happened was people found out how to machine them. Like there was a demand, and people found out how to make. And actually, from what I've heard, the bands that people are making now have a longer shelf life. Like,
okay, cool.
One of the original Nintendo bands had like an active life of about, you know, 8 to 10 years, mm-hmm. you know, until it would just, you know, it's rubber, you know, but, yeah. but like they're making them now that, that they say they're good for 20 years, you know, and you can just buy a bag of them for like, I don't know, if you go on like Yahoo, you can find like a bag of the of five of the bands for like $7.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, very cheap. And there's also specs. I've seen people make them.
Like, okay. Yeah.
Like, I mean, like non-professional people, they just, they'll just cut cardboard to the exact size that's like there's guides online for how to make them from stuff you can buy from your local hardware store.
Oh, that's cool. I imagine like with Famicoms, those are in such high demand, like a Famicom's an iconic system kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Where I feel like I was talking to when I was at the Portland Retro Game Expo in October, I was talking to somebody who was collecting for the Casio Loopy. And he's talking about the most expensive thing is the printer paper. And I'm like, ah, yep. I don't want to go down that hole, but maybe someday. I do want
to. I used to have a Casio Loopy. That's one of the things I sold in the great game purge of 10 years ago. I still have a couple Loopy games, though. It's not a great system, but like I love those obscure, weird ones. Like I used to have multiple Pladias.
Mm-hmm.
A Pladia was this system put out by Bandai that basically just played FMV games based on anime properties.
Okay, yeah.
Sounds similar to another system I can think of. But that one was aimed much more at kids. It had a Fisher-Price-looking controller, you know, so...
So actually, that kind of rolls into one thing I do want to ask about was the type of games that are increasing in price. Do you typically, you know, assuming the theory that, yes, the exporting of games is what's, you know, raising a lot of these prices. Do you typically see it where it's like games that are more accessible to the West are definitely higher prices than, you know, say, a visual novel on...
Oh, definitely.
A PC 88,000 or something like that.
Oh, definitely. No, definitely. I mean, your high cost games are going to be your shooters, especially especially like early bullet hell things. Shooters are incredibly expensive. Action games, platformers, things like that. You know, are always going to be expensive. You used to be able to get Super Mario Brothers for 100 yen easy. And now a nice looking copy, just the card alone, is going to be around you about $15 to $20.
That's pretty much true here too. There's a ton of Mario Brothers out here, but yeah, it's getting up there where it's like, oh, this game is, I think it's like Super Mario Brothers 3 is probably one of the most produced NES games, and it you can go to stores and they'll be sitting there with a $40 price tag on it. And it's like,
I know
why.
I don't have a. Yeah, that's a rabbit hole I've started going down recently. I've started to get nostalgic for my childhood, which has led me to start collecting NES games in Japan, which is dumb, like really dumb, because most of the games are almost exactly the same. You know what I mean? Yeah. And way cheaper here, but I just. They're something, and so Sean got me a original gray box toaster, you know, NES that I brought up with the light gun and everything, and started collecting NES cards, which again is so dumb for me to do here because NES collecting is already an incredibly expensive hobby, but when you're doing NES collecting as an import.
Even more so, yeah.
I know, but yeah, one can know that something's wrong, but still do it. You know, it's.
I'm looking at maybe importing two copies of Dirge's server as Final Fantasy VII. So,
I got one right here.
Oh man, don't tell me that.
I think it's the limited edition. It's got like a book or something with it.
Yeah, there's a couple versions, and I've definitely send me some pictures later.
Okay, yeah, this one definitely has the stuff about the online. It's got like a I was listening to your last podcast, Trevor. Like, I knew it had an online component, but I didn't realize it was Japan only because I'd been in Japan already. Yeah. So I figured that was something everywhere because Final Fantasy VII's so big everywhere, and the type of game is really way more Western than Japanese. I'm actually kind of surprised that Japan had that service and and the U.S. didn't. So yeah. Hey, I learned something from your podcast.
I need to find a, like, I was kind of scattered brain during that, but I really want to sit down and find a way to like arc. I spent about 6 to 8 hours reading about all that stuff and watching videos, so I'd like to put it in a more digestible form out there.
Yeah.
Like, here's an article you can read in 30 minutes and know what this thing is, because it's a really weird thing. But that's a topic for the last podcast, too, so
I'd really
I won't go
like,
too far down there.
I'd really like to commend you on your Team Innocent video. I thought that was a really excellent way to present it. Like, I've been telling people about Team Innocent for a while because I think it's a very interesting game, because it's trapped between two generations. It's unique for what it's trying to do, and I think it's a very interesting game. I don't say it's a great game.
Oh yeah,
But at the same time, it's not a bad game either. It's very much what it is, and I think from a historical perspective, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But so I think your video really captured the like positive and negative of that. That's the type of video that I'd love to be doing if I had more time to do videos.
Time,
you know,
I really appreciate you linking and everything and putting it on the website. They take a lot of work, unfortunately. That's why I usually only do them once every 6 months. But this year, one a month. We'll see.
Yeah, but the thing is, putting stuff out there, like. I really think that's why we started Famicom Dojo in the first place, because at the time there wasn't a lot of people like archiving this type of history and using the actual hardware and things like that.
Yeah.
Now there's a billion people doing it. So like the need for, but like your video on Team Innocent is the best English language video on Team Innocent that has ever been made, period. I mean, I can say that with all honesty because there's not many videos made about Team Innocent, but now that exists as a record. Now that's out there. And I think as content creators, like, that's so important, because content creation used to be that it was making, you know, scripted, researched content. And now everything's just streaming and gameplay and things like that, which has a there's definitely a place for it.
Yeah.
But I think because that stuff's become so popular, it's moved the people who are making the videos that we do to be kind of a you know, something that people do for fun, because there's no way you're going to make a profit off of it.
Yeah, I stopped trying to make money off of writing a long time ago. Actually, speaking of emulation a little bit, one thing I did want to kind of get back to was with, you know, you saying Japanese gamers, I guess, is gamers is a bad word. You see, the word gamers always feels weird.
It's fine.
You know, collectors or something, or the lack there of them because of how the market worked. Do you see more of a push to do more things like emulation? Like, emulation is pretty big here in the West. I don't know how in Japan, if it's as
it is
prevalent.
It is not. I mean, frankly, like, I mean, I'm sure that the younger people and the people I hang out with are mostly like my age, you know, in their late 30s, you know, because those are the people who are still, you know, hanging on with the Famicom and everything. And I still remember, like, I was telling one of my friends about, you know, like, because I wanted to play Fire Emblem, and I have all the Fire Emblem games, but like, there are games that I will play in Japanese if I have to, but my Japanese is not so good that it's a comfortable experience. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can get by, especially if a game's fully voiced. That's why something like Team Innocent's very nice, because almost everything's voiced.
Yeah.
But like, if older RPGs that weren't released in English, where it's all text, especially kanji text, like, I can get through it, but I gotta have my dictionary with me, and it's not playing games is something I do to not have to
work.
To not have to work. So, like, if I'm gonna play one of the older Fire Emblem games, I would like to play with a patch. Mm-hmm. Now, I've got my Retron 5, so I've been doing a lot of that, which is wonderful because you can apply a patch right to a game and play it on your TV.
Yeah.
Because for the most part, I like playing with original controllers at least.
Yeah.
And original hardware if I can. I'll do on the but. I'm a big proponent of legal emulation.
Gotcha. That's, yeah.
But and because I do own most of these games in their original version. But anyway, I was telling about how I was playing one of the Famicom Fire Emblem games, Fire Emblem Gaiden. Actually, I was playing.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, Gaiden. Oh my goodness! I keep getting, you know you. It's one of those things, like, it's written, it's a Japanese word, and I should be able to do it, but, like, when you've pronounced it wrong for so many years,
growing up. I still call Button Kaitos Baton Kaitos all the time.
So. Yeah, exactly. Like, I would, for, yeah, there's some that just stick because I always said them wrong as a kid.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was playing
the wizard
that
didn't
was...
correct you.
It was correct in the wizard. It was correct in the wizard, but it sounded wrong. It sounded like that guy was just being pretentious. Yeah, he's like Ninja Gaiden, and I was like, whoa, he's saying it wrong. Whoa, they should really hire people who know the words. And I'm like, oh, he's got. Sorry. We're going
yeah,
down a dark hole right now.
Let's get back to Fire Emblem.
Yeah, let's get back to Fire Emblem. Anyway, I was telling my friend I was playing it right now, and they're like, "Oh, that one came out in America," and I'm like, "No, it didn't." And they're like, "You're playing it in Japanese? How commendable!" Now I should have just taken the compliment and ran with it, but I was like, "No, I'm playing it through emulator," and they're like, "Emia who?" You know?
Oh, really?
And I was like, "You can play video games on your computer," and I'm like, "Oh, wow, how much?" And I'm like. Technically, you know, it's illegal, but like probably most people playing them are not paying any money, and they're like, "How is this allowed?" And I'm like, "It's not really, but it's not something that, you know, but just the idea." And I think that's why. But in general, like Japan's still mostly into physical, you know.
Yeah.
It's changing. It's changing now, and. You know, there's definitely a stronger push to have download cards and things like that. But, like, Steam is starting to make inroads into Japan, finally. For a long time, nobody knew what that was, even though it was they had it in Japan. But, you know, it's still a physical thing because, as I said, games still have good resale value here. And people still lend games to each other. Which is something that I know has kind of gone away in the United States.
Yeah, it's pretty rare I hear anyone ever like just lending people copies of games these days out here. Yeah. But I mean, I think a lot of the Western market just buys a digital copy anyways. So
yeah,
can't
yeah.
resell it. Can't, you know, anything.
Yeah. That's another topic as well. I know I'm on the wrong side of history on this one, but. I think physical is superior in every way, but
like with that Dirge of Cerberus stuff, it's scary. Yeah. Things get lost, you know.
Exactly.
There's
exactly.
no existing version of Dirge of Cerberus multiplayer at this point, and
I think digital will be an acceptable thing when it's digital plus actually having rights for the things you have, and that's not there right now. I think for video games to ever be considered truly art, they have to be in a way that will be able to be legally preserved.
Yeah, I wonder because like the digital side of things really is more a recent thing.
Yeah,
and so I wonder if that's something that's not really gonna. Feel resolved for another 20 years or so as things slowly switch over. I mean, maybe to the point that we don't actually have disk drives on systems anymore and things like that. I don't know. Yeah, it just feels so far out to think about that. Cause I feel like today everything's just like, hey, technically, legally, you don't have any ownership of this thing. You have the license to play this game kind of thing.
Yeah.
Even though you paid, you know, the full amount for it. I still need physical myself, but it's not always an option, unfortunately.
Well, it isn't. Although, luckily, in Japan, it's much more of an option.
Okay.
I mean, like, for example, I bought Okami for the Switch physically, and it's got full English on it. And, you know, a lot of the games that have been the Mega Man collections were only half physical in the United States, like only the first half. But you could buy the double cartridge set here in Japan. I've got Bayonetta 1 for Switch physically, which was,
Yeah, because it's the digital code, right, in the Bayonetta
exactly.
2 here. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, Japan, because they haven't embraced digital as much, still has a lot more options for physical. Although No More Heroes Travis Strikes Again was digital only in Japan.
Oh, really? Because it's physical here.
Yeah. That's so despite the fact that, like, a lot of the things, Switch has been wonderful for a gaijin gamer. You know what I mean? Like, because almost all the releases have English on them.
Yeah.
And it's totally region free. And for those few that don't, you know, I can just import them from the States, and the shipping is really cheap because they're light as heck.
Yeah.
You know, so the Switch has been wonderful. The Wii U was terrible.
Because
region locked system. The Japanese games almost never had English on them. So you know, Wii was the same. I wound up buying two Wiis, two 3DSs. And I was like, if Switch isn't region locked, if Switch is region locked, I was like, I don't know, I might just skip this thing.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's my most.
I'm getting to the point where I might have three PS2s, so yeah, exactly. One for each major region. So
yeah, that's why I don't let anybody in my game room here, because it's so hard to explain. Like, there's two Wiis next to each other, and there's like a twin Famicom and a Famicom and an NES, you know, and they're all basically playing the same games, you know.
But it's
I've
not.
Got, I don't know, I've got multiples of a lot of systems, and like that's hard to explain to someone who has maybe a console in their house total, you know, and a collection. I'm using the word collection of 15 games. You know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So they. I don't know. But you know what? Gaming is a good hobby.
It is a good hobby.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's way less destructive than if my hobby was like playing pachinko.
Yeah.
Or, which is how I justify it to my wife. It's like, you know, I'm not spending my money on drugs, you know?
And since you are selling that stuff, you are making some money back, kind of.
Like, okay, extent. Yeah. As I said, I don't make as much back as I invest into it. Because I'll go to a store and I'll be like, oh my gosh, look at these games. I could put all of these up on the store and I'll buy it. I'll come out with a bag of 30 games.
Yeah.
And by the time I get home, 15 of them have entered my collection. You know, and the others, like, you know, I'll get to putting them up. So, the reselling, at least. I don't know. I really, really do enjoy helping people find stuff from Japan, though. And I hope the lower prices I'm trying to set can do something to reverse trends a little bit, because if people stop buying off, you know, paying huge prices, especially, oh my gosh, the ones that are, what is it? The sealed copy that's been authorized by
in the plastic
video game,
whatever,
and you're like, I've got that game. Why is that game selling for $2,000?
I
have a new copy of that, and I bought it for $20.
I bought a bunch of GameCube games for like $5 when I was a kid, and then it's like, oh, Cube of War's $300 now. Okay, sure.
Yeah, what the heck? Which makes me terrified. No, seriously. Like, I have this angst. You know, like, I loaned a copy of the Wii Soccer Wars game, the one that came out that NIS released. It was one of my favorites. I loaned it to my brother, and it came back in bad condition.
Oh, that sucks.
So I'm like, I'll just buy another one. And I'm like, whoa, they're really expensive now.
Yeah.
Like, really expensive. And I'm like, oh, no. You know?
Yeah.
So now I'm, you know, I feel like I need to, I feel like when a game comes out that I feel might become rare, I will buy it even if I'm not completely interested in, just in the off chance that I might become interested in it later. I need a psychologist on this podcast, really. I mean, to tell you the truth, but yeah.
My rule of thumb is always assume everything will never drop in price and assume as soon as I buy it, it's worth $0. So that's the best way for me to do it. It's just like I buying this game because either it was cheap enough that its value of it being around is higher than me playing it immediately.
Yeah.
Or it's, I'm buying it for the value of the game, basically. Like, I probably shouldn't have bought First Kiss Story 2 from you, but it was $10, and I have a weird amount of First Kiss Story footage recorded now in case I ever need it, so maybe someday I'll need First Kiss Story 2 footage as well.
Did that arrive yet?
Not yet. It usually takes a while.
The thing about that collector's edition, and this is maybe I should have mentioned it to you, is it also includes the Dreamcast port of First Kiss Story 1.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, like, I thought, you know, you'd be able to compare the footage from that. And probably, since it's Dreamcast but not late Dreamcast, it's probably censored, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There might be something interesting, yeah.
First Kiss Story 1, I was expecting that there would be some problems. I was specifically not streaming it because I was like, this might be an issue. Because it says 18 plus on the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
There is very little to know.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
I mean...
I've played some more... more raunchier visual novels, that's for sure. This is basically like, sometimes they show up in their bra. And it's like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing now, though. There's nothing. Like, the censorship has hit Japan very hard in the last couple years. Ever since the Cero system came around, you can't, I mean, the stuff that was in Sega Saturn games and things like that, you can't do that anymore. It's very strange. But actually, yeah. I think games have become more pervy.
In some ways, yes.
I mean, take the Ranma 1/2 games.
Yeah.
For PC Engine, they had nudity in them, but they weren't even rated high. Like I, it's because it's kind of like more innocent, in a way. Because nobody's like because when it happens, it's clear that it shouldn't have happened, and characters are embarrassed, and you know.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But now, like, I don't know. Games have become weirder, you know? Like, like since you can't show, they find weird ways to still make them, like, I don't know. I don't know. Modern visual novels hold pretty much no appeal to me.
Yeah, I don't play them very often. I kind of lost interest.
Although I got a copy of Steins Gate coming because I hear that's the one to play.
Yeah, I have a friend that's playing that right now. That's like
Am I saying that right? Is it Steins Gate?
Because that sounds man.
that sounds like a German beer hall.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's a German thing. I can never pronounce the Xenosaga like episode names because they're all just.
Oh yeah, just say the number. Just say mess, the number. Yeah, yeah. They're all based off Nietzsche or something. Am I saying Nietzsche right? Is it Nietzsche?
Know.
Oh no! This is oh Nietzsche? Man.
I think yeah, Etchy.
You're finally gonna find out how many people are listening to your podcast because there'll be all these complaint all these pedantic writing in like actually you pronounced most words wrong during your podcast.
I pronounce most things wrong. So to kind of wrap up, one thing I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on was usually if I talk about retro game collecting in America, I'm very avoidant of things like the NES, Super Nintendo, things like that, because they're very expensive. So I always say, hey, like the Wii is a great place to shop right now. You know, there is some stuff that's pretty cheap. And, you know, 360 and PS3 right now is like a perfect place to buy things. And I think I'm very thankful that I don't really... I do cover a lot of games from when I was younger, like, you know, N64, PS1 era kind of stuff. But I don't feel married to them completely to some extent. Like if they ever go up in price, I'm fine moving on. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on if somebody were to start purchasing. I know earlier you mentioned PlayStation 1 was a good one to go ahead and do right now, because eventually it's going to get expensive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But I didn't know if you were thinking about, if you like had any thoughts on systems that are not as, you know, mainstream stuff, that maybe like the PC 88,000, you know,
PC
series, stuff like that.
That's an expensive platform to collect.
Is it really? I was wondering if it wouldn't be that in demand because.
Oh, sorry. I'm thinking of the X68000.
I've looked at that too, but that is also very expensive. So I did not look at it.
Okay. This is one that's gone up way, way much, because you used to be able to buy a lot of software for the NEC PC 98 series or PC 88 series. Most games would be under $20, but it's really gone up in price recently.
Do you think that's Western influence as well, or is that more of
I don't know. I think most of the software that's on that would be a little bit impenetrable to the Western audience. I know that that's one of the reasons MSX and the X 68000 system went up, because there's a lot of good arcade ports for those, a lot of action games. Early, I mean, I know the MSX went up because of Metal Gear. You know, people wanted to play the originals. And it's the arcade ports that brought the Sharp series of computers up. I have a Sharp X1, and I recently got Mario Brothers for it, so I'm going to do a video on that.
Oh, cool.
At some point. It's on cassette. It's very cool.
Oh, really? I didn't know it was on cassette. Very, that would make sense.
Very cool.
In that case, I am maybe young enough that I've never used a cassette for video game stuff. So in that case, you actually load the entire game ahead of time, right? Or is it?
It depends on the game. If some of the bigger games, you might have to do another load. When I started going into computer gaming was already about almost 1990. I invested in retro before retro was kind of a word. You know what I mean? Like, I had a computer that had a disk drive, but. My school was getting rid of a system that had a cassette tape thing, and I took it home, and then I started collecting, because it was from garage sales mostly. There wasn't eBay at the time. Swap meets were a thing. Computer clubs used to have swap meets.
Yeah,
I miss that.
You hear a lot of from my dad. He's a Commodore 64 at the time, and pirated games and stuff like that.
Yep, exactly, exactly.
I would like to get a Commodore 64 someday, but it's a wall that I've been holding in front of myself for a while. Like, that's too far. Let's leave it be, and I will not touch it.
Old retro PC stuff has really gone up in price too. Yeah. Anything magnetic media, really, and which I say. With behind me an entire shelf of Famicom Disk System games, so I recognize that there's problems in my life, and I feel a great nervousness towards magnetic media, because like it does have a shelf life, but I still want to collect it. It's very
well, all media does to some extent, cartridges being the most resilient, but CDs are eventually gonna be susceptible to disc rot and things like that.
I would like to point out, as someone who collects a great deal of games, I have right now over 3,000-4,000 disc based games right now, and over the time that I've been selling and trading and purging and rebuying, probably I would not be surprised if 10,000 disc based games have not gone through me, you know, and disc rot I've encountered 3 times.
Oh, okay.
And even then it might not have been disc rot. It could have just been peeling, paint from the label artwork that it caused, and I collect laser discs too, which are much more susceptible to disc rot than CDs. And again, I've only found a couple instances. I think the problem is overblown.
Okay, gotcha.
I think if you keep your games, I think things that people think are disc rot are sometimes mold caused by keeping things in a high moisture environment. I think there's a lot of things that lead to disc. Improper storage is bigger than. Hey, we'll see if you got any listeners, because this is a controversial statement. Because a lot of people, especially people who are for the all digital future, always tell me that my collection is doomed to failure. But You know, I've got PC Engine games that were printed in 1989 on CDs that work fine. You know, yeah. I think my games, not all of them, but I think the vast majority of my collection will outlive me.
I think that's true too. Like, I don't think disc rot is like a huge issue per se, but I do think inevitably it will happen. Eventually, all this media is going to die. But
it will.
But
it
I will be dead too someday.
But
so.
But so will we all. But I mean, but that leads to again another topic about the importance of preservation. Because if we really do consider games to be art, which I do.
Yeah.
We need to find a way to make it accessible and preserved, you know, in the same way that not everybody can own a Mona Lisa, but everyone should have access to it. You know, I think there's a lot to be said. And again, that's a different topic altogether.
Yeah, I hope someday that like being able to get access to ROMs and stuff will be a bit easier, because I would like to do more data mining stuff. That's something that I've always wanted to do, and it's just
that's very
I gotta go to some shady websites to get ROMs sometimes. I'm not here to play the game, I just want to see what's in here and poke around. But I mean, I totally understand as well. But nobody's gonna put out Shaman King Master of Spirits again. That's a video game that will die in my hands.
Is that the one that's like basically a Castlevania hack?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Master Spirits 1 and 2, which I believe it did not come out in Japan.
No. Which is weird, because it's a Japanese anime. But yeah, that happens sometimes. It's so weird sometimes how some games only come out in one territory when they're so... Like, okay, take Disaster Day of Crisis for the Wii.
I love that game, yes.
You've played it. Good. Most people in the States haven't, because it wasn't released officially there. Yeah. But it's the one region where it should have been released, because it's basically an American action movie as a video game. Mm-hmm. And it was released in Europe, where the Wii was, you know, not doing well. And it was released in Japan, all in English. You know, it's just like... It's like, what... You know, you missed the main target audience here, or whatever. And like, your Shaman King, which was not a popular anime in America but was in Japan, wasn't released in Japan. You know, just stuff like that. Yeah.
I think what I gathered from it when I was looking at it was basically the anime series had kind of run its course by the time those GBA games came out. Versus in the West, they were still localizing the Shaman King anime, so it's still had a popularity.
I guess that makes sense. I guess that makes sense.
You may already know this, but Disaster Day of Crisis, the English and or the PAL and the Japanese release have all the same voice actors, but all retakes of all the voice acting. So there's reason to play both of them. You can hear two different sets of delivery.
Wait, what? Yeah. I did not know this. You have the PAL version, right?
I have the PAL version. I don't have the Japanese version.
Man, you know, I hope a few of the people listening to this podcast will buy some things off my site. Japan Retro Direct, by the way. Because after talking with you for a little while, I'm taking notes right here of some games that I have to buy. So I'm going to wind up losing money being on your podcast. So,
yeah, and I'll say, like, you gave me praise on my video earlier, so I feel only so much I can say. Like, I have been incredibly satisfied with your service, and
thank you.
I bought a Super Nintendo controller through you mainly because I know you test your stuff, and you know, I would rather go ahead and get something through you that I know is going to work versus just taking a shot on a cheap controller out here and not really knowing. But yeah, it's always been a great service, and I've always
thank you.
Of you going out of your way to find random garbage for me too when I need it.
you do request some odd things. I've never tracked down Windows 95 games for anybody before. That was new.
Got to play First Kiss Story Bingo. Somebody's got to do it.
Does someone though? No,
I don't know if I'm even going to be able to get those things to work, but we'll figure out.
I am very much looking forward to your retrospective video on Hunex. By the way, I found a PlayStation 2 Hunex game that I'll tell you about it later.
Okay,
I saw it and I'm like who's going to buy this, and I'm like, I know a guy.
I will say, like, I want to do something on Hunex. They have made so many video games, and many of them are visual novels that I do not know if I could do anything with.
No.
But we'll see. I need to do something with Hunex Fighters at some point. I just don't know what, because it's not big enough to be a video per se, but I've already spent like $80 on buying stuff for it, so...
I mean, frankly, you know, for people who do collect PCFX, though, like, I mean, I've been collecting PCFX for a while, and I've heard of the legendary, you know, fighting game within First Kiss story, but I never took the time to figure it out myself. I just saw a video on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I just took it as a word that it was there and put it and filed it under something I'll do someday in the future, but like you wrote that you sent me a guide for how to get to there, and if there was a video out there, like it could, you know what it would do? It would contribute to First Kiss story prices going through the roof, though. You know what I mean? Like it would, because it would cause like American fighting game fans, and I keep saying American, but actually, a lot of the people who are moving this stuff from Japan are actually from France.
There's a lot
of people from France, especially collecting Neo Geo stuff. A lot of people from France. Don't know why. That and PC Engine. A lot of people from France. Like,
I always hear about them having a big yaoi market there, too. Like, it's huge. So, I don't know. Maybe France just has a very big Japanese interest.
I think so. Because, like... You'll see that a lot of like manga that was never like that was never localized for the American market does have like French translations. I'm a big fan of Dr. Slump. Do you know Dr.
Okay,
Slump?
Yeah.
It's first big series by Akira Toriyama.
This girl with like Dragon purple hair, right, with a baseball cap on.
Arare-chan, yeah. And the anime had never been translated to English other than a few fan subs, and the fan sub group got theirs from the official French releases of the DVDs.
Okay, cool.
Which I thought was really cool, because you'd think there'd be a market for that, because Dragon Ball's so huge and there's a lot of crossover between the two series, but anyway, yeah, it's so strange how localization works sometimes.
Yeah.
I was visiting, for my honeymoon, I went to Spain, and I was surprised to see Crayon Shin-chan everywhere.
Oh, okay.
Which is something that was got a weird adults-only localization in America.
I watched it. It's very weird.
Whereas it's totally a kid's show in Japan. Like, but not a particularly great kid's show, but...
Yeah.
but anyway...
It felt tailored to like the Adult Swim market here,
exactly.
And so, then like Saint Seiya, and is it Brazil? I think is where. It's
yeah,
like, South America
and
stuff like
that. South America in general, like yeah, and King of Fighters is bigger than Street Fighter in like Mexico or something.
Yeah,
you know, like there's all these weird pockets of like what is it, the Master? Yeah, the Master System is still a thing, like in Brazil. Maybe not now, but like as
it was
a few years ago.
Yeah,
they were like porting games that never should have been able to be played on a Master System to the Master System, like
Sonic
the Hedgehog. later Mortal Kombat and things like that. Yeah. Like yeah, just by the way, I love that. I love it when people port things to systems that never should. Like I like Halo for the Atari 2600. You know, I like it when people try to do... There's a Chinese-made Final Fantasy X for the Famicom.
I do remember that, yeah. And Final Fantasy VII as well, I think, right?
Yes, yeah. I think that's amazing. And I wish I had more time to dive into stuff like that, but...
There's never enough time.
Oh, man, My younger self would never believe me if I told them that there will be a time where you won't ever have run out of video games to play.
Because when I was a kid, never have the time to play any of them.
So when I was a kid, I'd get a game for Christmas, I'd get a game for my birthday, and if I was good that week, maybe we'd go to the supermarket to rent a video game. Yes, from the supermarket to rent a game. The games were near the game section was near the birthday cakes.
Yeah.
But this idea that time would be the cause of not being able to play video games rather than the lack of video games. That would have just blown my 8-year-old mind.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Vink. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And yeah, if are you guys planning anything for Famicom Dojo in the near future, or is it still kind of on hiatus?
I mean, we are right now. Sean is working on our new website, our 2.0 version of the website. Okay. It really needed a revamp, and so people can check that out. There's a video I've got in progress right now that I did along with my daughter. About you know what, here, I haven't even revealed it to the Famicom Dojo podcast. It's going to be about Sakura Tyson Columns.
Okay. It's just like a Columns skin with Sakura Tyson, or
basically, yeah, it's easily the best version of Columns, because I never found Columns to be that interesting as compared to Puyo Puyo or Tetris, but they found a way to make it a lot faster paced, and they put on Sakura Tyson characters, which I'm a big fan of that series.
So. Cool. I will look forward to that, because I've definitely not heard of that, but I also have never played Columns, so.
Okay. All the footage has been taken of that for months, but like I got a newborn in the house, so it's hard to find the time to edit. But that's on the way. And I know Sean's, got some, things that have been filmed that he's putting together too. So, I don't think we're going to go back into full production of Famicom Dojo for a while just because of, you know, how busy we both are, but there'll be a few things, randomly hitting, you know, before we go back into full production.
Did you guys ever finish 16-Bit Wars? I can't remember. Okay.
I mean,
at some point, I just kind of lost track of where that was.
Yeah, but I mean,
I totally understand. Yeah, though.
We made the mistake of trying to. I mean, back when we launched it, it wasn't a YouTube series. It was a TV series that was on YouTube. Like we were trying to pitch it as episodic with an ongoing story and a plot and connections between the episodes, and that's so not how YouTube works anymore.
Yeah,
like. Nobody does like episodic content anymore. Everything's just like vlogs and things now. Or they do, you know, like your Team Innocent video, it's a standalone.
Yeah.
You know, but to do a season around a theme, like we still haven't finished the 3D special, because we've teased for years that the third episode was going to be about the Virtual Boy.
Yeah.
Which I've been collecting for. I have all of the common Virtual Boy games now. I'm lacking a few of the like $400 plus games, but I'm never going to get those. I say now.
Research. But, sometimes research calls. You can always sell it back.
the big problem is whenever we try to conclude our series about the 16-Bit Wars, we learn about something new.
Yeah.
That distracts us, and we make a different video, and I mean, we'll get back to it. Like, luckily, no one watches our videos, so we're not disappointing too many people.
So. Well, yeah, I'll look forward to it. I definitely have loved your guys' content for, I to guess, 12 years now. At this point, it's been a chunk of time.
It's 12 or 13 years. Yeah.
I will say, people like you and Rami at Go Nintendo were very inspirational in creating this kind of content when I started.
You.
So I really appreciate the time and effort you guys put into those videos.
Even if
it was a relatively slow rollout, but like I said, I also totally understand that it takes a lot of time, and I don't have a family I'm trying to take care of. So yeah. Well, thank you for your time. And then just again, Japan Retro Direct is where you can go. I highly recommend Ving's website for importing Japanese goods. Always the best prices I found. Everything's just in great quality every time.
Thanks.
So I appreciate it. That's it for this week. Thanks for coming, and I hope you have a good week.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
Bye-bye.